voice going on there for a minute.
What's the deal with?
Hello and welcome to the Emerald City Video Hello. Podcast. This is Russ and Zach, as is often the case. Weirdly, for those of you who actually shopped at Emerald City, we are coming to you quasi-live, because we're driving now, from Soundgarden in Syracuse, which is essentially our soul brother in terms of being the local non-corporate record store. And Soundgarden still exists, and they have so many used DVDs that Zach and I were there to get movies so like many. If and Crank and Dogma. And of course, because I need one, an extra copy of Josie and the Pussycats.
I got an extra copy of Cradle of Rock.
It's true. Both movies were...
Actually, everything I bought was an extra copy, except for Canadian Bacon, which I probably have on, maybe on VHS somewhere, or something like that. But
I'm pretty sure, I think you can buy it on Amazon and that's it, but anyway. We're going to be talking today a little bit about Dunkirk. I don't expect this to be the hour and a half bonanza that our last few, like, reaction-type podcasts have been. Why don't you start, Zach?
I do wish that we had been able to see it at least a like we went to one of the smaller cinemas at Destiny.
Surprisingly still full, like a month and a half after the movie
crap,
came out.
Yeah. Yeah. I
mean really full.
Yeah. I mean only like the first maybe two rows were not at least mostly filled. Maybe, you know, not, on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah,
not,
I mean, granted, it's Labor Day weekend.
That's true, yeah. And the crowd was, basically old enough to, for the most part, actually have witnessed it firsthand. other than, like, the fact that I regret not seeing it, seeing it on a larger screen, because yes, Mr. Nolan, you are correct. It should have been seen probably on a 70mm print. Would have been nice though if you actually had made one available
anywhere
other than New York City.
I'm walking here.
Like, which is a 5-hour drive. I think the closest drive was to Toronto or Montreal or something like that. We would have had to gone up there, which. I don't know. That's the limit of my leaving the country to see a film is a bit much. But there were 5 screenings in New York City area. It would have been nice if you made one up there. But other than that, again, this is like after how many months? It's been out for a month?
Yeah, I think it's 6 weeks-ish.
6 weeks.
I could be wrong. But.
So that always kills a little bit of the novelty. I've heard a lot. I mean, I didn't hear. I mean, there's no like spoilers or anything like that. I mean, yeah, we kind of know.
Yeah.
It was good.
I feel like it was the most Christopher Nolan-y Christopher Nolan that ever Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, it was definitely Nolan-ish.
One thing is, can you remember the name of any character in this movie?
I don't think there's any point to that other than George. Yeah, which I think that may have been part of the point.
Yeah,
but the pilots probably had the most dialogue, and then
there's probably 35 lines of dialogue in the whole movie, which is about a 2-hour-ish movie.
Yeah.
And that's really what I mean by the Chris Nolan thing. Like, it's a movie that is entirely predicated on the idea that, like, I'm going to make a big spectacle movie that's going to make you dizzy to watch and that's going to be beautiful and it's going to be blah, blah, blah. But these characters don't matter at all. Like, it's not that they don't matter, but they're archetypes. Like, their individuality is totally subsumed to, like, the narrative of the film, capital F film.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not inherently a bad thing. I'm kind of making fun of it because Christopher Nolan does this as much as he can in every movie.
Yeah. I mean, you're 100% right, where it's the most Nolan film of Nolan's. Which, again, is definitely not a bad thing.
No, it's kind of like...
Dear Lord, I mean, if we're going to start talking about, you know, auteur directors, at least this film wasn't 4.5 hours long and had a Tree of Life, had that...
Yeah,
that 30-minute, which I loved. I loved that so much because I'm a pretentious asshole.
Twin Peaks, which ends tonight, which is pretty much just an 18-hour David Lynch movie. And actual David Lynch movie, like Eraserhead David Lynch movie. But I thought it was beautifully shot. It was, you know, and I thought it was really compelling. I thought that the choice to jump around in time was interesting, but not necessary.
Yeah. It took me a minute that, because there was literally match cuts where, yeah, like, they would tell the story of somebody else and then kind of continue on and then,
yeah,
and then move on. And that was, because, like, part of it was at night, part of, and then they cut back, mm-hmm, to somebody. But certain parts were, that was, I don't know if unneededly confusing.
I don't think it was necessary. That's the thing. I think that it was intentionally confusing. I think that, yeah, it was, the whole thing was part of him trying to just depict the chaos, yeah, of the situation.
Yeah.
And so I think that he found a little thing he could do that would, like, both illuminate some character motivations and also,
yeah,
he found a way to do it that would both inform the audience and also confuse the fuck,
yeah,
out of them.
Throw you for a loop.
And
a
so
bit,
he,
yeah,
wanted to, like, toy with that a little. I don't think that the film really benefited from it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it, I guess if they had, like, I kind of wish what they had done was been able to, like, tell a story and then cut to the next story and then be able, yeah, to tell, because all the stories were, you know, like,
they were
one of the
not,
pilots got, yeah, shot down, and then the ship, which I guess, I don't know how you would do that necessarily unless you went, like, really arty, so
yeah,
I guess
it,
maybe,
well,
I'm wrong,
would,
but...
Again, it would end up being, like, Tarantino or, like, what, yeah, Doug Liman did with Go, yeah, where, like, you would have to, like, tell the story up to the point where the two interact and then cut,
yeah,
and then tell another story up to the point where they're about to interact, yeah, and then cut, and then once all the stories were told, you could pick up and,
yeah,
resume.
Which,
it would have been inelegant, but I think, yeah, that it would have been better storytelling.
Yeah.
But again, like, there was nothing really wrong with it, except for the fact that it called so much attention to itself that I felt like this feels kind of maybe unnecessary. And especially, like, Cillian Murphy's character, we don't actually get any... There's no exploration of him in the, like, the quote-unquote flashbacks.
Yeah.
Like, we see him for, like, 15 seconds in, yeah, the... Because there's the night and the day, and you find out about half to two-thirds of the, yeah, way through the movie that the stuff from the night had taken place the previous night. And so you're seeing kind of how certain people got to where they were, yeah, when you meet them. And so, like, Murphy's character, we meet him and he's a major part of, like, the today story.
Yeah.
But then the last night story, it's like we literally just see him and he has, like, four lines and that's it.
Yeah.
And certainly, like, you can kind of... You can fill in the blanks for yourself, and maybe what Nolan wanted to do was to let you fill in the blanks for yourself and not spoon-feed, yeah, the audience.
Yeah.
But it also kind of feels like we didn't need to see him, yeah, in the night, because, like, there's nothing that you learn from seeing him kind of pre-trauma,
yeah,
that you can't assume by meeting him post-trauma.
Yeah.
To me. Like,
yeah. I mean, I guess it adds some... Because, I mean, he comes off as a dick, basically. I mean, obviously, he's, yeah, shell-shocked and whatever, but he comes off because no one else. He's kind of the only, yeah, one that takes shell-shock that way. Kind of, maybe there's a handful of people who are, yeah, like, rocking back and forth and hiding. He comes off as, you know, vaguely violent.
Yeah.
And, you know, spoilers, but I won't get into that, but there's no need to. I'm kind of okay with it. It is, you know, that now that we're talking about it, it does remind me the way that filmmaking did. It's so thin red line that...
It's been a while since I saw that, but that
well,
was...
it's Terrence Malick, yeah, so I mean, you, yeah, you know, basically enormous look.
Yeah.
You know, only when you're trying to express extreme emotion, yeah, do you ever get close to somebody.
And if there's a filmmaker that Nolan would want to be when he grows up, it's probably, yeah, Malick, because...
Yeah.
I feel like Christopher Nolan would trade his commercial success,
yeah,
for the ability to have, like, what Malick and to a lesser extent, like, John Sayles have in terms,
yeah,
of uniformly,
yeah,
like, everybody loves them and nobody questions them.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, because people question Nolan because his box office success makes him such a mainstream figure.
Yeah.
And so you look at a movie like this and, like, you have assholes like us who are going, like, well, he could have done blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Whereas I think if this movie was done for $30 million instead of $150 million,
yeah,
and this movie was done by literally anybody except for Nolan, you just look at it and be like, man, this is one of the great war movies of the last,
yeah,
25 years. Which, I mean, inarguably, I think it is. I don't think that... I can't think of another war movie that, you know...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, top 10 level of, like, it goes in there with, you know, even though I don't think Thin Red Line, is, or I'm sorry, not Thin Red Line, you know, Saving Private Ryan is one of the greatest, but, you know, it goes up there with Saving Private Ryan, it goes up there with...
it goes up there, I mean, one thing, you can get into the whole conversation of Saving Private Ryan, it's probably not worth it, but, like, it, the thing that it's famous for, which is that kind of incredibly visceral first 10 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
Dunkirk kind of does that 10 minutes over and over again throughout the movie.
But it does... What I like about it does... And I think that something that Thin Red Line does masterfully, which is it... There is no hero death in Dunkirk. There's a handful... brief moments, but I mean, like, so you have... is it Killian or Cillian?
I think it's Killian.
Killian. You have Killian Murphy, like... He's a complete... Basically, they pull him out of the water. He's completely fucking terrified because he's like the only guy that survived his ship going down. I mean, it's unbelievable to think about what he witnessed, how many people were down. You kind of have that image already in your head because he's sitting on top of the, you know, the back of the ship.
Yeah,
with
and
the
it's,
propeller
it,
in the
you,
air.
Yeah, exactly. You can't really tell what it is at first. I couldn't even tell that he was on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, all you could see was, like, the hull and then, like, the prop.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, as you get closer, you see that there's, like, a person near the prop.
Yeah.
And it gives you the scale for, like, oh, this is clearly a destroyer, because the prop is, like, 10 feet.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
So eventually he becomes, not a hero, but he does what, not only what he's supposed to do, but like, very, very human moments. And then there's these two characters that barely say any lines whatsoever between them, because we find out that one of them... find out that one of them is not English,
so he's
trying to hide that. I mean, you kind of know it before, you just don't know whether he's English, whether he's something else.
I mean, I certainly, I didn't necessarily catch that he wasn't talking so much as I caught the kind of squirrely way he was acting.
Which is actually, it's interesting that it wasn't really weird, because you have so many characters.
In this,
you're probably like... 12, like, people that you're supposed to know.
Yeah.
And then four of them don't really speak at all.
Yeah.
Like, three of them are giving orders to people, so that's how they speak.
Yeah.
And then, like, what, one of them has, like, the kind of, if there's a main character, probably the one character, at the end of the film where he's reading the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
That was the longest bit of dialogue, I think, in the entire film, which was interesting. And it's, you know, it worked. It's hard to say, because it's hard to, what I was saying before with the Thin Red Line is that Thin Red Line is the only film of the past, I'd say, 20 years or so, big quotes around mainstream when it comes to
that. Yeah, because that was a movie that...
But it had fucking George Clooney in it, had all these people in it, depending on what cut you out of watched, at least. I'm still waiting for that, like, supposedly he has a 6.5-hour cut of it or something like that. It's, like, fucking insane. Where he has, like, everyone in the film. Well, no, there's, like, remember there's, like, 45 people in that film with, like, A-list actors. Mm-hmm. And then he cut down to, like, 12 people. But, we're talking about Thin Red Line, of course. What that film does is it brings out, because there's these moments where, like, I'm trying to remember which actor it was, isn't, like, just relishing in the beauty of the South, you know, South Pacific and where he is and looking at everything. And then you have, like...
Brana, you mean, or...
What's that?
No,
I'm talking in Thin Red Line.
Sorry.
Not South Pacific. But he's relishing in just the pure beauty of it, and then the warships come in, and then you basically cut to, like, the banality of, like, being in the steerage, and then the pure terror of war. And to me, that's always when you read books about, you know, the, you know, whether they be anti-war books or whether they be just books about war, it's the, what is it, you know, the boredom and the terror, you know, is that what they really focus on. And Saving Private Ryan, that's actually why everybody talked about how it was an anti-war film. I'm like, I don't see that. There's so many heroes in that film.
Yeah.
There's so many moments of excitement and laughter and all these things. And but what Dunkirk did is a very similar thing, a very British version of that to me, because Thin Red Line was American and in the South Pacific. And to me, that's just like these two films could almost be, you know, the different areas of war during World War II. You could literally watch these two films together and almost and have that same. They have that same feel. They have that big feel to them, which is why, like, now that actually more and more talking about it, more and more I'm actually liking Dunkirk through Thin Red Line, like as a story, which actually be interesting to ask Nolan on how much, if any, inspiration on that. But sure, he would answer that question.
Yeah, but I feel like it's such a weird, like, he doesn't seem like the kind of guy who would really cop to that. But at the same time, he did kind of cop to it with The Unforgiven and the third Batman movie.
Yeah.
Like, why does he always have to have something covering his
voice? I know.
Isn't this like the third or fourth? Somebody already made this joke, so we're not being original on this. But this is at least the second, if not third or fourth. I'm trying to think of his other films that he has.
I think Fury Road.
Oh, Fury Road. Yeah.
But the other thing is, he had the same, like, the weird voice that people made fun, like, not just having something covering his mouth, but the weird voice. Yeah, the lilt.
Yeah.
In his voice that people made fun of for in The Dark Knight Rises, like, Tom Hardy had that again a little bit. And it was, he didn't talk very much, so it wasn't super obvious.
Yeah.
It was a movie that I think captures the side of war that doesn't get captured very much, because a lot of it was very boring.
Yeah.
And
basically waiting for death.
Yeah.
Like, that's it.
And then a lot of it was, like, very, like, there was a sense of anticlimax to the end of the movie. Like, you were happy to see, like, that people survived, although if you knew your history, you knew that they survived. But, the quote-unquote happy ending that we get is that Harry Styles' character thought that everybody would be mad at them for losing the beach.
Was that Harry Styles who was grabbing
I'm pretty sure that's who that was. Yeah, I think
Funny, this is one moment where we should call a friend and
call
my 16-year-old sister.
I'm just assuming so from his hair. Because he has the big hair.
Yeah.
But, like, that character, like, basically you had the bit where he basically is talking about how, like, well, we lost, and so everybody's going to be pissed at us.
Yeah.
And, like, I can totally get how, like, your headspace goes there if you're, like, a soldier.
Yeah.
But realistically, like, in the Western world, we kind of have, like, the cult of the soldier where you don't, like, because something went terribly wrong, doesn't make you any less, like, brave for having, like, tried to stop it.
Yeah.
And so, like, there's that weird element of, like, the quote-unquote happy ending that we get is, oops, I should buckle back up because we'll start beeping. The quote-unquote happy ending we get is basically just him coming back to a semblance of reality where he's like, oh my god, everybody's gonna hate us, they're gonna throw tomatoes at us when we get off the train. And then, like, you get there and everybody's cheering for them and throwing, like, giving them food through the window as the train slows down, and, like, you know, quiet smile, walk away. The weirdest thing, like, the weirdest filmmaking choice, like, and again, like, I nitpick the filmmaking because it's Nolan and because, like, everything he does is so super deliberate. The weirdest filmmaking choice in the entire movie was the last shot, because, like, you get the shot of, like, it closes on one actor's face. I can't even remember who.
Yeah.
And, like, the music swells and it goes, dun, dun, you know, you get the final note of these movies.
Yeah.
And the screen goes black for, like, 2 seconds, and then it comes back up and you see the same guy and his facial expression changes, like, very slightly, and then it just fades to black and it's the end of the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just like, wait, did you...
Why was that?
Forget to turn the camera off or something?
Yeah, because they finished. I don't think we've hit spoilers on this, so I'd rather, like, really spoilers. So
yeah.
But, I mean, like, so something happens to one of the very, very main characters.
Yeah,
you can say that. Like, and something kind of you kind of have a feeling is going to happen throughout.
Yeah, you know, it's
to
one
to
of the
back
again.
Of
there's
the film.
There's very little in the way of dialogue, but one of the few pieces of dialogue you get is, like, planting the seeds for this ending.
Yeah, and so, like, that would have been this. I think it would have been this. It's hard to say whether it'd been that fantastic ending, and then they cut to I think they cut to him on the train, don't they? Or they cut to...
No, it was... I think it was literally the same... Like, I think it was the kid standing there talking to his dad.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the camera goes off, and then it's just... Camera comes back up for a second, and it's that same kid.
Oh, I forgot. Yeah, the newspaper thing happens first. Okay, yeah. No,
but, like... But yeah, so it was just very odd. I honestly, if it's me, and again, this is really nitpicking, and I'm not Christopher Nolan, but if it's me, like, the last shot would have been about 5 seconds earlier. Like, because you don't... So much of this movie was Nolan trusting his audience and treating us like smart people and not needing to spoon-feed us everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the last, like, 5 seconds of movie was, like, spoon-feeding you to make sure you understood the relevance of that final symbolic act.
Yeah.
And so you're just like... Okay, so the last 5 seconds of your movie run counter to the philosophy of your direction.
Yeah.
And so I think you could have ended the movie on the shot of the newspaper and just been like, instead of having the meaningful glance, camera off, camera on, smile, camera off.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I can think of... because there's a lot of... not nods, but just very like, okay, so this is, these are stoic British people. Yeah. And then there's like, we have to emphasize, look at, they do have emotion.
Yeah. There's that.
And there was, I mean, which is great. I mean, which is why you watch a British, you know, which is why you watch a war film with British people in it, because
is this the first...
they don't have to be the Americans, you know, who are crying or who are like being emotional and being patriotic.
Is
and
this these the guys first just, movie that, that Nolan has done since like Following that actually felt like it was a British movie?
God, I don't know. I'm trying to think of anything else that
he... I mean, he did Insomnia, which was a remake of like a Belgian movie or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like this is the first time that like Christopher Nolan's inner Brit was allowed to come out.
Yeah.
Since he became famous anyway.
Yeah. I can't think of anything. I mean, everyone acting in it is, you know, I mean, I think everyone is actually British, or at least Irish, or at least...
Yeah,
you know,
at least something with an accent.
You know, at least they're in the British Isles, and...
I think that, too, if you watch this in your English, there's probably a very different read of it that you get on certain things. Like, I know that, like, during one of the big climactic things, when you see the people coming together, there is a moment where somebody says, "Where are you from?" And someone says, "Dublin." And all I can think is, like, that's supposed to be showing that, like, the Irish came together with us. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And I'm sure there's a lot more of that I didn't catch because I don't know that much about England.
Yeah. I don't think it was Dublin, though. I think they said some other...
But whatever it was, area? It was Ireland.
Ireland?
Well, there were two. Because there was the lady who was definitely Irish.
Then, on the boat. Sorry. I thought you were talking about a different moment. Yeah, so, I mean, it's... Yeah. I don't know where I was going to go with that, but...
Sorry.
Yeah, no.
Derailed. I will say, one of the... Again, like, speaking to the fact that you have an English director and English characters and an English setting, and... they come up and they're like, "Oh, we want to see the cliffs." At one point, it feels kind of odd that the soldiers say this, but I think that the soldiers at this point are just the audience avatar, where they're just like, "Is that the cliffs of Dover?" And the kid on the boat is like, "No, that's something else."
Yeah, some other person. Yeah,
but it's just like, "Oh, I get it," because like for an American audience, when they came up and say, "We want to see the cliffs," immediately you start thinking, like I started thinking, the cliffs of Dover.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I mean, it's also the first thing if you cross the channel, like it's the first thing you would end up seeing going, at least I believe, going the way that they would have gone. So, I mean, it's obviously seeing home.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I think are really, there's a lot of things that I think are fairly subtle in this that really worked for me. Because I do like the philosophy of trusting your audience and not having to spell every little thing out. I also really liked the fact that there is a character who you assume to be dead for about half an hour, and then that person resurfaces in because of the way that they're playing with time.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And you're like, "Oh, that guy."
Yeah.
And, you know, for all me saying earlier that I didn't think that playing with time added much to the movie, I will say that, like, if there's anything it added, that was probably it. Because you're just like, "Oh, cool. Like, now you have this."
Yeah.
There was also what I felt like it probably wasn't an intentional misdirect, but, like, there was, like, a minute where somebody says, "Oh, yeah, my son, ... And, like, the way I was reading the movie at that moment, it really felt like Tom Hardy was going to be his son.
Yeah.
And then, like, it's literally 10 seconds later that they explain, like, who the son is and where he went and blah, 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 blah. And so it was that weird moment.
They would do that in a Spielberg in American film. Exactly. Like that's the difference. It'd be like, no, you can't have that many coincidences.
If this movie was Magnolia.
Everyone's interconnected and and thank God it isn't.
That
would have taken off.
I think that they had the perfect amount of interconnection with like what they did with the pilots.
Yeah.
That was a nice bit of, and I really liked, Tom Hardy for, you know, and again, like, in a movie where there's so little dialogue, a lot of the actors didn't have much to do. And they all did a good job with what they had, but nobody really stands out as being spectacular because nobody had that kind of part. Yeah.
I think that I would say the
old
pilot, the captain, the old guy, he was, I mean, he was given literally a typecast role of, like, his character could literally have been in a 1940s or 50s film, and he fucking hit it spot on.
Absolutely.
And he had good...
I do think if there's, a supporting actor's nomination to be had for this movie, which there probably is not, but if there is, it would be that guy.
Well, it'll be interesting because I think that that's all you really should have been able to have. I don't know how to categorize.
Maybe Branagh, because Branagh did a lot of, face work, too, but...
Yeah, I mean, but Branagh, literally was, I am Branagh. He was just being kind of Branagh. In his role, but the pilot, I guess he's the captain, of the merchant vessel, just the yacht.
I can't remember what the classification of the boat was. They said it twice, but for the most part, people just referred to it as a recreational vehicle or a yacht. It was driven home. This is a civilian.
But his, his basically kind of his insight and kind of talking to Cillian Murphy's character and dealing with him in a, it was actually really kind of nice because there was certainly a couple moments
there were a couple moments where you were just expecting that he would throw Cillian Murphy into the water
or lock him away or something like that, and in fact there is a moment where his son, the captain's son, locks him in the stairwell, which the door would never hold, so I'm not going to know what that purpose was. But
like the balsa wood door.
But either way, it is, It has some nice, especially since we still occasionally when we want to talk about PTSD in this country, honestly, this would be a good film for people to possibly watch to be like, okay, so you have to actually understand that, this person is, it's not a triggered thing. It's not a whatever. It's, this person is seriously saw some fucked up things and they actually deal with them quite nicely.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is though, that I found is that they have such an opportunity to speak even slightly ill of the British's dealing with Dunkirk, which is kind of was a spectacular fucking they kind of lay out that it was a chosen thing. We know we may lose all these people because the next battle is going to be literally on our shores, so we can't waste anything. But it is interesting that it was such an opportunity, and there's a handful of soldiers being like, well, what, where the hell's good things going on?
Yeah.
But even then, and again, I think that this, so reads into the, doing a Russian accent would have been a better, we are British, and this film just kind of screamed that, every kind of trope that you know of, British soldierdom and captaining and everything else, it's right there.
One of the things I want to talk about a little bit, because it occurred to me very, very late in the movie. When you talk about war movies, and especially about propaganda films, and I think because of the negative connotation of the word propaganda, people would be hesitant to drop this into there.
Yeah.
But I do think that this movie has all the hallmarks of a traditional propaganda film.
Yeah.
Not least of all the fact that the Germans are completely dehumanized in every way. You don't see one, ever. You do not see a single German face.
Yeah.
Even when they show up at the very end, there's a swarm of them.
And stuff like
they're
silhouettes. Yeah.
But the one time you see a human with a gun who you think might be German, it turns out to be an English guy who doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
Or no, a French guy who doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
In the opening crawl, they refer to him as the enemy.
Yeah.
The only time that the Germans are actually explicitly named is when, at one point, when they suspect somebody of being a spy and they want to hear his accent.
Yeah.
And so, to me, it struck me as, like, that's a thing that's worth mentioning.
Yeah, because you don't see the, you know, I mean, usually in the dogfights in the air, usually at least see...
You'll see, like, the pilot POV the eyes from both or something planes. Like that,
and you just don't see them at all. They're not just... They're just distant. They're not even... You don't even see a person in them.
Yeah, and, well, and the only ways that you see... That you interact with the Germans at all is either disembodied gunshots or the bombers trying to kill as many people as possible, including bombing the medical boats and bombing, like, groups of huddled masses on the beach just waiting to get home.
Yeah.
And so it really, like...
And taking shots at, you know, civilian vessels, which obviously are transporting people, but...
Yeah. And so it's one of those things where you're just like, it is... It's certainly not the most monstrous depiction that you'll ever see of the enemy, but it is the most dehumanizing in the most literal way depiction of the other side of the war that I've ever seen. I've never seen a movie where you literally never see... Well, I mean... Okay, yes, you'll see the movies that are set essentially in the foxhole.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you never see the other side because it's not that kind of movie. It's a character sketch about the guys who are in... But, like, in a movie that's this wide scale, that has this many characters, that has this much... Like, I don't think I've ever seen a war movie where you just don't see the other side at all.
Yeah. Which, though, again, I mean, it's... I mean, it brings to the... There's almost, I mean, other than the kind of the aerial dogfights, I don't know where the opportunity to is.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose you could, like, you have could them have the behind the snipers, you know, that's shooting the guys in the street or something like that. But, I mean, other than that, it builds the, it builds the terror, which is how they would have actually seen it, which to me is, which is why it works. To me, it actually works a lot better than
I mean, it wasn't a criticism per se. It was just a, like, this is an interesting thing. And I haven't had... I'm sure loads and loads of people have talked about it, but I haven't read it being talked about.
Yeah.
I didn't read a ton on this, but, you know.
Yeah, I didn't... Yeah.
That one bomber that just kept getting away.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just like, okay, so, like, now that we... Like, this bomber now has a character arc in some way.
Yeah.
Because, like, there's so much going on with it over such an extended period of time.
Yeah.
And so... When I realized that we had no idea who was piloting that, that's when, like, my brain started doing a mental inventory and realizing we haven't seen a single German in this movie.
Yeah, that is weird.
So it was, and again, like, I like the choice. It's just, like, it's a very, it's, and again, like, Nolan is the kind of guy who's incredibly deliberate.
Yeah.
And so everything is a choice.
Yeah.
But, just... worth mentioning, because to me it was like a thing I realized late, but it really struck me. Any closing thoughts? I know that your phone just popped up and told us something, which I'm guessing is that you're low on hard space or something.
I can't I can't really think of anything else. I mean, definitely recommended.
Definitely.
I would imagine it's a Nolan film, so it's hard to say it wouldn't be, but...
I will say it's occasionally hard to watch. And also, like, in terms of, like, if you're a super mainstream movie fan and, like, you have those criticisms in your head of, like, artsy movies, that they're slow and or boring.
Oh, yeah, this is slow.
Like, this is very slow. This is very boring. This is very... But it's I mean, it's, you know... Yeah.
No, well, I mean...
And again, the kind of boring that it is a deliberate kind of boring because it's building tension for... It's like a horror movie.
Yeah.
But like, I will say that, like, all the things that you think about Christopher Nolan movies, if you are a person who doesn't love Christopher Nolan, you're absolutely right. And that's this movie totally. So just be prepared for that going in, because it's worth... sitting through the things that you might not like, because the movie is that good.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, like, you're not going to sit down. It's not going to be Saving Private Ryan, where, like, you know by the end of the first scene who you're cheering for the next hour and a half.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, the other thing, too, is that, you know, assuming, obviously, this is a, you know, mainly a video podcast and this thing's still in the theaters, even though it's only two showing a day on a Sunday for where we are, once you get it, you know, get the Blu-ray, get the 4K, and watch it on the biggest screen you can find.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I really think that, like I said, I think it seriously would have changed.
Yeah, I think have, seeing it, like, in IMAX and seeing it, you know. That was definitely a thing where...
This actually would be a great film to see in,
with the VR goggles, just because of how big it is and how, like, because I mean, obviously we sat, you know, in the back, not all the way to the back, but kind of, you know, mid center, and you know, you can still kind of see people and everything like that, which is which is sometimes good if you're watching a film, like, to, because you're watching a film and it's a group, it's supposed to be kind of a group experience, which is one of the things Nolan, you know, I mean, Nolan upset, which is why I'm bringing it up, but the fact that, you know, I've seen, you know, I mean, you see, you know, the greatest example is Malick Films, and I personally love sitting really close up on Malick Films, like the first, like, six or seven rows at a big theater, and just being like 100% immersed in it, because, you know, like, this film is very stripped down, very bare. I mean, it's enormous, but like,
but
the dogfights are like, you know,
His ethic is that he wants practical wherever humanly possible.
And the whole, I mean, and part of the whole point was, is that basically you've got 400,000 men on the ground, which you see them, and then everything else is like, there's like 12 ships and tops, and only one, you know, by the end, like only one fucking plane anywhere to be found, which is part of the point of it, but it's still like to be able to be looking at it on a large screen of one way or the other, you know, just sit yourself in front of a large, you know, 60-inch screen.
Yeah, I will say, like, if you're the kind of person who gets, like, vertigo, be careful of it, because, like, and again, this speaks to his like, desire for kind of practical elements. Like, it's probably the most realistic take you'll ever see on, like, certain things in terms of how explosions affect things and how, like, how boats sink. Like, you know, so much of the time in Hollywood, like, boats sink basically just by going down. Like, they've got a hole in the bottom and it's filling up slowly.
And also, boats sink over, like, if you watch Titanic, it's like 40... It's three hours in the film, it's 3 hours. And clearly, they want to you to think it's like 12 hours. But no, like, in this, you know, which they would if they're hit with a torpedo.
Yeah.
It also shows, I mean, like, you watch a lot of American films. I mean, I was just thinking about, like, watching this. I think the last, like, kind of warship film that I saw was Battleship.
I was going to say Periscope Down with Kelsey Grammer.
Well, no, but in that film, like, so they're in a traditional, they're in warships, and they're in, you know, in battleships, shocker. And they get hit, like, three or four times, and somehow they don't sink, and they're not having problems. And, like, these boats get hit once, and they're going down, because they get hit with a fucking torpedo, and they're metal, you know, I mean, there's no time to close anything or do anything. And so, you know, it is, it's so much more practical on... kind of how, what the idea is that you be able to survive any of this stuff.
What I will say is there's one ship and you see it sink twice because it you see it in both the real time and then the flashback. But that one, when it goes like, it gets hit on one side, kind of catches fire, and then it basically capsizes to that side and falls on top of the side that's on fire. And so that then later in the movie when you see it again, it's basically just sideways. And all I could think was that the physics of it look right to me. Like, it looks like very much like the Titanic thing, like the real life Titanic of like, you know how the Titanic went down because we've done computer models and you've seen the painting and all that kind of shit. But like, you know, contrary to the movie, it happened in like the actual like break and then sink before it slowly sunk into the ground, into the water. Like the actual like dramatic part happened very, very quickly. And that's kind of how this one is. It's like, hours later, it's still sitting on the surface of the water because it trapped all that air and, you know, but like, it's no longer a viable vessel within like 10 minutes. So, but definitely check it out. Definitely worth a look, even though this is not exactly a contemporary. Like, usually we do these, like, the response videos, and it's like, oh yeah, because this movie came out a minute ago. This one, we're just kind of like, there's nothing else in the theaters right now. We didn't want to go see Inhumans and pay $15 for that, as much as we would have liked to make fun of Inhumans, because that's pretty much what we expect.
And everything else was just, I mean, like, there's certain, again, I mean, there's certain, obviously, this is a, you know, I had premises a video, videotape podcast, but, you know, I mean, there are certain films, like, I knew, like, I had to see Dunkirk in the theaters again. Like, if I get an opportunity to actually see it in IMAX, I will go see it in IMAX again. I'll pay that, whatever the fuck amount of money it is.
Really? It's only 14. Well, it's Syracuse.
In Syracuse, but, But yeah, but so, I mean, like, that's, you know, everything else on a theater. I mean, yeah. I feel like that's a lot of films now. Yeah. Even a lot of action films where I'm like, eh, I can see this on my, you know, 40-inch screen at home or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah. But anyway, yeah, before it stopped raining, so we're going to run in.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon. We want to talk about Mars a little bit. So.
Yes.